From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Gorlott, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Today, Joshua Landis will compare what he calls the Great Sorting Out in the Middle East to historical East European conflicts that also stretched across ethnic and religious lines.
The First World War brought down the Russian Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the German Empire, and of course the Ottoman Empire, the one that's most important to us in the Middle East.
Later, Joshua and Rebecca Cruz will talk with Matthew Barber. He was one of the first bloggers to write about the capture of thousands of Yazidi women and girls as the minority community of northern Iraq was wiped out this summer.
I was accused of fabricating all of this in order to defame the Islamic State. ISIS themselves published a document publicly disclosing their slavery revival project.
An eyewitness account of the aftermath of the Sinjar Mountain siege. The news is next. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlott. Joshua Landis, back to the Middle East, Syria, Iraq. Bloodshed continues. We just sometimes don't know how to make sense of what we see going on there. Christians being driven out of the region, Yazidis being ethnically cleansed. Can you put this in perspective? I mean, we just tend to think this is about Islam. This is about religion. This is about people that hate each other, Islamic fundamentalist extremists. But there's something else going on here. Am I right? I mean, what we've seen this stuff happen before. This is not new, right? So, Joshua, give us this historical perspective, if you will, that will help us understand.
Well, the way I've recently written an article about what I call the Great Sorting Out, and this is part of the nation building process. I compare what's happening in the Middle East today to what happened in Central Europe during the interwar period and the Second World War in particular, because all of these nation states were created on the same date in 1919 at the Paris Peace Conference. The First World War, the great empire-destroying war, had brought down the Russian Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the German Empire, and of course the Ottoman Empire, the one that's most important to us in the Middle East here. But the people all mixed together, ethnic, religious, mosaic, they were left within these borders. But in the Second World War, you get a great sorting out. Poland was 64% Polish before the war. By the end of the war, almost entirely Polish. Czechoslovakia, 33% minorities. Almost all of those are gone by the end of the Second World War. This process goes on right down Central Europe. We've seen it in Ukraine today with the Russians and Ukrainians being divided. And even in the Crimea, 6% of Crimeans were Germans, for example, before World War II. Hitler occupied it. They became collaborators in the eyes of many people. When Stalin retook it, all those 6% were driven out. And this process has gone on. 12 to 13 million Germans were ethnically cleansed from Central Europe between 1945 and 47, right after the Second World War, because they were seen as the guilty minority. The Sudeten Germans in Czechoslovakia, the Polish Germans were all expelled. And the Jews, 6 million Jews, killed many minorities, the Gypsies, so forth. So this great sorting out is part of a nation-building process. It's long, it's bloody, and people find it hard to live together. We saw it in Czechoslovakia, in Yugoslavia, most recently with the collapse of Tito, seven nation states built out of Yugoslavia. So in a sense, the many multi-ethnic countries of Syria, Iraq, Palestine, Israel, Lebanon are being sorted out, and that's why we're seeing so many of these minorities sort of expelled, like the Yazidis, like the Christians are hard put, and religious nationalism is overtaking the region.
So can we expect then that – you said it's going to be long and bloody, obviously, but how long? I mean, I know you can't predict the future, but are we to expect that in a decade, two, three, five, 10, we'll see some stability in this region and perhaps even democracy is what we've seen happen in Europe, Central Europe, Southeastern Europe?
It does have policy implications, because what America is trying to do in bombing ISIS is to reconstitute a secular Iraqi national identity in which Shiites and Sunnis are going to get along together. And Kurds are all going to – these different ethnic and religious groups are going to somehow compose their differences and find an amicable way to live together. If what I'm saying is largely correct, this great sorting out, this is going to be a very difficult project to do. And we see in the middle of, from Baghdad to Damascus, a new big state having been created by the Islamic State, ISIS. And America is trying to destroy that state. But it's going to be very difficult to do it without creating some mechanism for self-determination for these Sunnis that are trapped between two Shiite regimes in Damascus and Baghdad.
Well, Joshua, thank you so much again for sharing this historical perspective that's really important for helping us understand what's going on in the region. Thank you.
Thank you, Suzette.
And we have a video of Joshua having a much longer discussion with Danny Postal from the University of Denver's Center for Middle East Studies on our website. And there's also a link to a blog post where Joshua outlines his argument at kgou.org. You can follow him and his website, Syria Comment, on Twitter at Joshua_Landis. I tweet at Suzette Gorlot, and you can find this program at Worldviews KGOU. Coming up next, we'll take a deeper dive into some of the issues we just discussed with Joshua's Syria Comment colleague and University of Chicago PhD candidate, Matthew Barber. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot. Our guest, Matthew Barber, is finishing his PhD in Near Eastern Languages and Cultures at the University of Chicago. He also helps our regular panelist, Joshua Landis, run his influential blog, Syria Comment. He works with Northern Iraq's Yazidi minority and was there this summer when self-proclaimed Islamic State militants waged a campaign to wipe out the community and enslave over 8,000 women and girls. He recently led a group of Yazidi religious leaders to meet dozens of senators, congressmen, and U.S. State Department officials in Washington to explain the story of the Yazidis and the large Christian community driven from the city of Mosul.
Matthew Barber, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you so much. It's good to be here.
Well, we're here to talk today about a really disturbing situation that's going on in the Middle East. And you've had a lot of firsthand experience with the Yazidi people. And I wonder if you could just give us some background information about who these people are and what's happening to them right now.
Well, the Yazidis are one of the only remaining Near Eastern religious minorities that has non-Abrahamic roots. They have a mixture of many different narrative elements that they've appropriated from other traditions, and their religious framework also preserves some very ancient pre-Zoroastrian, old Iranian religious motifs and rituals. The Yazidis are particularly vulnerable to Islamist violence due to the fact that they do not have a written scripture, which the Quran places significant importance on. They also have a number of beliefs that are interpreted as polytheistic by Islamists or by Muslims generally. Yazidis have also been branded as devil worshippers due to the fact that their chief deity, the peacock angel, seems to resemble the Lucifer or Iblis character of the Christian and Islamic creation narratives.
So this is an ethnic and religious population, ethnically tend to be Kurdish, is that correct? And a religious population that is now under attack by the Islamic rebels in Iraq and Syria?
Yazidis are almost entirely Kurdish-speaking. However, some of them identify as a unique ethnicity, separate from Kurds. In fact, most people from the Sinjar Mountains identify as Yazidi ethnically, whereas Yazidis that live in the Dohuk area, which is inside of Kurdistan province, many of those Yazidis identify as Kurdish. This has a lot to do with political tensions that exist within that area. And the events that occurred this summer exacerbated this tension to the point where more and more Yazidis are identifying as non-Kurdish, as simply Yazidi. What's important to understand is that on August 3rd, when ISIS attacked the Sinjar Mountains of the Yazidi homeland, the Peshmerga troops, the Kurdish military that was responsible to protect the Sinjar area, fled without a fight. They didn't even defend the Sinjar area for a single day as civilian families tried to evacuate. This led to the crisis of mass enslavement of great numbers of Yazidi women and the large number of deaths of many Yazidi people as well. Had the Peshmerga actually defended the area for a short time, many of these people would have been able to escape without the catastrophe that ensued. It might not have prevented the mass displacement that has happened, but the scale of the disaster would have been greatly reduced. So Yazidis today are feeling a tremendous sense of betrayal, and they no longer feel that they can trust the Kurdish government, the Kurdish regional government, to protect them. They have felt this way for a long time about the central Iraqi government of Baghdad, and they feel it now with the Kurdish government. And this is causing a lot of Yazidis to separate and to ask for direct international support to protect Sinjar, since they can't get that protection from the governments that are responsible for them.
Now, you mentioned that there's been a lot of women taken enslaved. How big is that? How many Yazidis are there? How many women have been enslaved? How do we know this?
When I was still inside the Kurdistan province this summer and Yazidi families were flooding into the Dohuk governorate as refugees, I went around and began to interview many of the families that had fled. And one of the things that I noticed right at the beginning were people telling me that some of their family members were missing, particularly female family members. I would talk to a person who would tell me that his daughter, for example, had been kidnapped, and she had notified him that she was being carted off in a truck through a cell phone that she managed to keep hidden with her. So a number of people that were on the ground there in the area began to be aware early on that something wasn't right, that there was some kind of kidnapping campaign that was underway. But it took us a while to understand the scale of this phenomenon. Now, I'm working with a small team of Yazidi volunteers who are trying to track and quantify the number of women that have been kidnapped and taken away. For a while, our estimate was about 3,000 to 4,000 women and girls. Over time, we were able to collect more and more data about the numbers and whereabouts of kidnapped Yazidis. And we learned that in some cases, entire families had been kidnapped, including men. And in those cases, when entire families have been kidnapped, the men are forced to convert to Islam. We know of mass killings that have taken place among those that have not been willing to convert, to leave their Yazidi faith and convert to Islam. And in those cases, it's usually just the men alone that are killed, and then the women are subsequently kidnapped and enslaved. When the men agree to convert, it seems that in some cases, families are allowed to stay together, but they're not allowed to leave. They have to stay and prove their sincerity by learning the Quran and learning Islamic prayers. This is a smaller number of the total Yazidi population that has been kidnapped and enslaved. Most of those are female, girls and women. The estimate that we have today, unfortunately, is between 6,000 and 7,000.
Now, Boko Haram is only 200 to 300 women, and they're not sexual slaves. This is a much bigger phenomenon, and these women are being sold as concubines in many cases. How come people aren't this hasn't gone viral and people aren't aware of this?
First of all, I believe that the enslavement that Boko Haram has engaged in is a form of sexual slavery, because they've kidnapped women to serve as brides, right? As forced, they're basically taken into forced marriage, I believe. But you're right; it's only a few hundred women, 200 women at the beginning. We're talking about several thousand Yazidi women. We are also confused as to why this has not garnered more attention. We're not sure why the media are not dwelling on this story.
You were just in Washington this last week. You talked to many high officials in the White House, the State Department, think tanks, and why this hasn't caught on.
You're right. I was in Washington with the Yazidi delegation just 2 weeks ago. We had meetings all over Washington with government officials, with people on Capitol Hill, with the media, with various humanitarian organizations and think tanks. Everywhere that we presented our message, we were met with a great deal of sympathy. People care about this situation, but translating that compassion into action seems to be something that is met with a lot of obstacles at the moment.
Require America going into these areas and putting boots on the ground is what it would require in order to get the extract these women.
We think that if the airstrike campaign that is already underway was utilized to target the locations of IS fighters that are keeping these women captive, and they coordinated with Kurdish or Yazidi ground forces, that a very reasonable ground operation could be conducted to free a large number of these women.
That's Matthew Barber, who helps Joshua Landis run the blog Syria Comment and works with Yazidi minorities in northern Iraq. More of his conversation with Joshua and Rebecca Cruz after a break. I'm Suzette Guerlat, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. We're joined today by Matthew Barber, who was in northern Iraq this summer when Islamic State militants attacked the minority Yazidi community and trapped them on Sinjar Mountain. He recently traveled to Washington to describe the plight of the Yazidis to Congress and the U.S. State Department. And when we left off, he told Joshua Landis and Rebecca Cruz he had a hard time translating the lawmakers' and officials' compassion into action.
What about the international community? If the United States isn't willing to get involved, I mean, what you're describing is perhaps at best ethnic cleansing and at worst perhaps genocide. What about the United Nations? What about other international actors that should be caring about these things?
The United Nations has recognized that at least the motivation on the part of ISIS to attack the Yazidis in the form that they did is genocidal. They haven't referred to the event as a genocide. We're not sure how many Yazidis have died. Some people think around 5,000. It's not as big a number as usually occurs when a large massacre is labeled a genocide. But the intention is genocidal in that the goal has been to erase Yazidi presence from the area. And ISIS has stated that because this group is polytheistic, as they interpret it to be, they should not exist within Muslim lands, and God will actually hold Muslims accountable for allowing them to have existed for this long. And this is also the basis for the enslavement project. They believe that because this is an unprotected group that is non-monotheistic, that they have the right to take their women as concubines. Yazidis are asking for a direct oversight from the international community, from the United States, and from the United Nations to make sure that Sinjar can be protected.
Now, if we look at both Syria, yeah, Iraq, minorities have been disappearing there in this sort of cauldron of nation building and civil wars between different people who are caught in the same nation and uncomfortable in the same nation. We're seeing lots of minorities being wiped out in Iraq, and it speeds up with America's conquest in 2003 because the state collapsed, there was disorder, and then minorities become preyed upon. Are there other minorities that have disappeared or largely disappeared from Iraq?
There actually are a number of religious minorities in northern Iraq that are even smaller than the Yazidis. You have groups called like the Shebek, for example. You have Turkmen Shiites. You have a group called the Kakai, also known as the Ahl al-Haq. You have the Mandeans, which are also a very small group, more in the urban areas. They lived in Baghdad. But all of these groups have suffered tremendously. And this kind of pressure due to nation building that you were referring to predates the security vacuum that was created by the U.S.-led war in Iraq. During the Saddam years, Saddam tried to count the Yazidis as Arabs as part of his Arabization scheme, even though they are not Arabic speakers for the most part. They were native Kurdish speakers. But he was playing with demographics in such a way as to boost his project of redefining the demographic landscape. And part of that involved destroying scores of Yazidi villages and relocating thousands of Yazidis into these collective villages in different locations where he could keep an eye on them. Yazidis have been feeling pressures like this for a number of years. Of course, the security vacuum that resulted from the U.S.-led war in Iraq really created conditions in which the community became the recipients of greater levels of Islamist fundamentalist persecution. In fact, the single most deadly suicide bombings of the entire decade of the war in Iraq were in the Sinjar Mountains against Yazidis, killing between over 500 people in one instance.
Now, what about the Christians? We haven't spoken about the Christians, but this summer, with the Yazidi attack on Yazidis, many Christians were driven out. That can't be part of this Islamic project of the ISIS because they're part of the Abrahamic tradition, part of the Abrahamic religions.
So ISIS actually distinguishes between the minority groups that it deals with, and it has a somewhat nuanced approach to how it approaches each one. Christians this summer were entirely expelled from Mosul en masse. The IS jihadists that guard the entrances of the city, the checkpoints in those areas, they stripped them of everything that they owned. They took all their possessions. They took wedding rings right off the fingers of women. They took the cash that was in the men's pockets. They confiscated the cars and vehicles. And those people basically entered the Kurdistan province destitute with nothing. But even with that terrible situation, they did not conduct a widespread campaign of slaughter of Christians or of forced conversion or of enslavement of female members of Christian families. So the way that they have dealt with the Yazidis is different. And that comes down to their understanding of the Christian community as belonging to an Islamic category known as Ahl al-Kitab, or people of the book. And they believe that that category of people have certain protections, a limited number of protections within an Islamic society. They do not believe that Yazidis share the qualifications to receive those same kinds of protections. And that's why they believe that Yazidis are a legitimate target for enslavement, whereas Christians are not.
Let me step back just for a second and get an idea of your role in this story. I mean, we are just now coming to learn of this group. ISIS is really something from this past summer that we're hearing about. But you have spent time in this region. You've been with these people, and you just this past summer were there when much of this was going on. So how did you get involved, and what were your personal experiences?
Well, I've been to northern Iraq 3 times, and I've conducted research there in the past about the Yazidi community, about some of their efforts to conduct legal reform projects and other things. And this has helped cultivate a relationship between me and Yazidi leaders over a number of years. And I happened to be in northern Iraq this summer, hoping to continue with some research projects and also study Kurdish language, when all of this unfolded. So it positioned me to be able to publicize and convey voices, Yazidi voices, survivor accounts of people that were trapped on Sinjar Mountain, to convey that to the rest of the world and give people a sense of what was happening there. After I started to understand more about the enslavement crisis, I became more involved in working with Yazidis to confront this problem. And that's what took me to Washington with these others, with this delegation, to actually push for action, to intervene and help save hopefully several thousand women.
And you were, in fact, one of the first people to bring to light some of these concerns that were going on. For some time, there was belief that this wasn't really happening. There wasn't a lot of evidence until you brought it to international attention. And then ISIS confirmed that this was happening.
There were a few voices talking about it. I was among the first. There were a few other articles, but people weren't paying attention to it very closely. I was accused online by a number of ISIS supporters of being a liar, of fabricating all of this in order to defame the self-proclaimed Islamic State. But ironically, it was a couple months later that ISIS themselves published a document broadcasting, publicly disclosing their slavery revival project.
Well, just a horrific story all the way around, and unfortunately we're out of time, but we will certainly keep following this and hoping that it comes to a good resolution for these poor men and women. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to Joshua Landis and Rebecca Cruz's conversation with Syria Comment blogger and University of Chicago PhD candidate Matthew Barber. You can find a link to some of his writing and an audio clip where he describes the history of the Yazidi people on our website, kgou.org. Worldviews is a collaborative partnership between the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies and KGOU. Brian Hardzinski produces the show, our research fellow is Symphony Swift, and our digital content interns are Hallie Arias and Sarah Hurd. For Joshua Landis and Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Grelott.